You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Watch what you watching. Fox keeps feeding us toxins. Stop sleeping, start thinking outside of the box and unplug from the matrix doctrine. But watch what you say, big brother is watching. Watch what you watching. Fox keeps feeding.
Man, how is it okay?
Listening to Reparations in Action, the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee, the organization that was founded by our special guest today 40 years ago in the city of St. Petersburg, Florida in 1976. APSC was formed as the organization of white people working under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party with the mandate to organize in the white community for white reparations to African people. It is the vision, theory, and strategy of Chairman Omali Yeshitela, the founder and leader of the Uhuru Movement, that is validated today by the continued existence and growth of APSC on its 40th anniversary. As the chair of the African People's Socialist Party, Chairman Omali Yeshitela's leadership and influence is felt throughout the world, spanning continents from South St. Petersburg, Florida, to occupied Azania. The chairman has spoken for the African nation at international conferences in Russia, and traveled throughout the world from Ferguson to Jamaica to unite African people into a revolutionary movement for African liberation through revolution. Today, we are honored to be interviewing Chairman Omali Yeshitela to understand how a revolutionary is made, and specifically how the chairman himself became the revolutionary leader he is today. We feel it is extremely important to feature this topic on our radio program, and we hope to do a monthly series of interviews with our chairman on the life and times of Chairman Omali Yeshitela. Today is the anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, whose autobiography galvanized millions of African people with its inspiring story of the political birth of Malcolm X. The history of the chairman has also inspired millions, because it is not just the history of one individual, it is the history of a movement, the history of a people's struggle, and the history of a revolution. It is also living history, a history that unfolds with ever greater intensity today as the struggle of African people moves closer and closer to victory. We are honored to introduce our special guest today on Reparations in Action, Chairman Omalia Shetela. Uhuru, Chairman.
Uhuru, comrade.
Uhuru. I also want to introduce Penny Hess, who was one of the white people who attended that conference in 1976 and joined the African People's Solidarity Committee and is the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. Uhuru.
Uhuru. Uhuru, Jesse and Eric, and Uhuru, Chairman Omalia Shetela. It's really an honor to have you on the show today, and I'm just very, very honored to be able to talk to you. And I know that you and the African People's Socialist Party embody so much history, and history that we must know about, you know, that everything didn't just happen yesterday. This is something that goes back to another era, another time of struggle, and you are a veteran that bridges the gap and has brought so much leadership to today. And I just wanted to talk to you about some of that history. I wanted to ask you some of the questions. And as Jesse said, over the next few months and time, we want to, you know, talk to you about a lot of this history. And in this time, we want to talk about your very early years, the awakening of consciousness in a time of the African Revolution and your role in it. So I would like to just ask you, as a first, you grew up here in St. Petersburg, Florida, and as a child, what most influenced you to become a revolutionary in your later life?
Uhuru, thank you for the question. And what I would like to say is we can speak about a particular kind of incidents that played a role that influenced me as a young person, but I think it should be also contextualized in terms of the history, the time in history that I was fortunate enough to be born into. And that was a time where anti-colonial resistance was beginning to take off all over the world. It was a time where the United States government was becoming also the most powerful economy in the world as a consequence of the Second Imperialist War. And so struggle was happening everywhere. People were engaged, non-white people were engaged in freeing themselves, ourselves, from white domination. And, you know, to start this discussion in 2016, it's really necessary to say that the majority of the world was unapologetically ground down under the boots of white people and white power. It was a nasty, horrible situation, as bad as it is today, with something like 80% of the people on earth trying to survive off less than $10 a day. It was worse then. And the in-your-face murder. I grew up reading, I learned to read through the newspaper and as a toddler, as someone still in diapers. And the stories that I was reading were stories of African people, men particularly, who were being lynched and murdered or throughout this country. So I think I can't overstate the significance of the era that I was born into, not just an era of oppression, but an era where resistance was beginning to heat up around the world and beginning to impact on the consciousness of everybody. I was born in 1941, 1947. India became independent, 49. China became independent. Of course, we saw Cuba, you know, all these other things. But I experienced also the murder of Emmett Till, who was just about pretty close to the same age I was when he was killed, and something that actually traumatized the entire African community. I grew up in a period where we used to, as you know, St. Petersburg, Florida is a tourist city. It's almost a beach, except for the areas where African people live. And to get to the beach from where I lived, we would walk as children from our neighborhoods to go to the beach. And we had to walk through white neighborhoods and the downtown areas. And there have been times when we've been stopped in the street by white people and white men who threaten us with knives and you know, threaten to kill us walking down the street and the white police stopping me and then without any comment taking me to a shop on Central Avenue and asking the white man, is this the one? And the white man just happened to say, no, that's not the one. In this case, I don't know if the next person they got was the one or the white man said mm-hmm. that was the one or not, but that was common. And so to grow up really conscious of the ability of white people to kill you with impunity, really, really mm-hmm. conscious of that, to know that any white man, and to grow up and to even know the look in the eyes and the curl of the lip that indicated that white people were upset, a white man was upset and could kill you, this was something that impacted, had an effect on the consciousness of me and every person of my generation. But it was also a generation that when a child was born, it was common for the women, African women in the community to come, especially if it was a male child, and ask, is this the one? And I'm sure that was tied to some biblical kind of thing, because Africans became infatuated with Christianity as a religion of resistance. That was the initial basis for the infatuation that African people had with Christianity. And so people would come and say, is this the one? This was a common kind of thing. In every household that you went into, there was always a discussion that people used to call race talk, where Africans was summing up what the hell was happening to us and who was a good race man and who wasn't. Who was it that would stand up for African people and the, you know, the possibility and probability that white people would kill us. So this was part of just the reality that I live with and that Africans here throughout the country live with. And we live with this whole thing about the rape of white women, that the notion that's all it took. And white women kill more Africans in this country, African men, perhaps than African men. All a white woman had to do would say that you looked at her wrong or said something wrong, and it could cost your life. And it did cost a lot of lives. And I spoke of Emmett Till, who, you know, at 14 or 15 years old, was accused by this white woman of having whistled at her. And that was enough for him to be taken out of his grandfather's house in Mississippi in the middle of the night and tortured and murdered in the most mm-hmm. grotesque and brutal kind of way. So that was the reality that we lived with. And the thing is that it was a reality that was, there was something that we did live with. It wasn't like it was extraordinary or that it was unusual. That's just the way it was. And people who grew up into that didn't know any other way. There was the impression that it was always like this. That's how it was to grow up in this city, in the South in particular, in much of the United States. That was the era I grew up in, and those were the kinds of things that helped to shape my consciousness. Uhuru.
Uhuru, Chairman. I mean, that is just really, really powerful and really true, what you're raising. And I think about that era that you're talking about, that you sum up constantly, that you always say, you know, that just as you did now, that you were fortunate to be alive, to come to consciousness at a time when the whole world was struggling against right. colonialism. And you know, I think if we look at history, we look at that history and we see just the exuberance of the time because people, you know, revolutionary movements were fighting U.S. imperialism and European imperialism in all its forms, but also ideologically and culturally, these questions were coming out and forces like, you know, Frantz Fanon and Richard Wright and, you know, just grappling with the question of decolonization, what this means, and the just bursting forth with the kind of incredible genius of the African working class that is so much like today, you know, in so many ways. It's just very powerful. And I just see you as so much a part of that, you know, the kind of actions you took as a young person and the stands that you represented.
Well, Fanon was later, but certainly Richard Wright. And I don't think Wright is someone who is sufficiently recognized. This guy captured the emotions and the reality of being an African in this world, and even the relationship we had with the white people who love us, in quotes, better than anybody. And to read Richard Wright as a young African is to be touched in deep and very profound mm-hmm. way. He knew us and he knew our conditions, and we could see ourselves in Bigger Thomas, and who, you know, the protagonist of Native Son. And we could see ourselves in all of the stories that he wrote about. He was an incredible genius doing that. So that was really important. And, you know, I grew up like in the city. People, as a child, as a youngster, I was constantly challenging the status quo. And it wasn't, I think, because of anything so special about me as it was truly the period influenced how I understood the world and what we had to do. And I would constantly, my father, who had been had walked literally from Georgia to Florida as a younger person, and who had brought many of his brothers and sisters here after him, but whose family had sharecropped, etc., who was a laborer in a railroad yard. I was constantly upset with my father, and because I thought he gave too much deference to white people. And I lived at a time where it was not unusual. It was absolutely usual for white people, the insurance people who would come to your house and walk in your house without knocking on the door. Mm-hmm. And I was so incensed by this. I was the person who was always confronting them and get out of the house and this kind of thing, too often to the dismay of my father and my mother, because they knew what white people would do to you. And I was the one who, if my mother was not with me, would catch the city bus, and the back of the bus, near the back of the bus, there was a yellow line behind which African people were supposed to sit on the bus. And I was the one who, if my mother was not with me, I would refuse to sit back there. I would sit, you know, any place I wanted on the bus, and, you know, would, you know, run into contradictions like based on that kind of thing. And so, I mean, resistance, I have, as long as I've understood, well, even before I understood what resistance was, mm-hmm. I was struggling against that. And we represented a really generational break from our parents. And my mother, and I think mothers of African men of my generation, and perhaps not just mothers, but I think mothers were the primary disciplinarians in African households, but my mother would actually beat me for any transgression, because she wanted to beat it out of me before the white man got me. So the thing was that she would try to break my spirit so that white men would not kill me for any suggestion of resistance. And when Africans actually learned how to walk and how to look in a certain way that a white man or white person wouldn't think they saw any resistance in your eyes, head down, body stooped and what have you, just the most you learn how to be non-threatening. And even today, there's a situation where young African men have to always function as a non-threat, to be a non-threat to white people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's to say that we have to always appear to be non-threatening to white people, because we are always suspects, and police is always going to stop us and do something to us. So the thing is that we have to appear non-threatening to white people. Participated in a deep and profound awareness of this relationship that existed. And it wasn't just the police. As I said, you know, white women could kill you at whim. A white woman could kill you and was responsible for so many black people dying. All she had to do was point a finger. And sometimes white women did this to African lovers that they had for any breakup, or Africans who refused to enter into relationship died because a white woman pointed her finger at him. And this was a part of the reality. And sometimes, as you know, white women would be the ones goading white men, saying, what kind of man are you? You let this thing happen to me. It was a white woman who went and told her husband that Emmett Till, a 14-year-old child, whistled at her, you know, et cetera. And that was a death sentence. So that was the reality that we live with. I talk about it as if it were past tense, but there's some way there's nothing past about it in terms of it protected. What I'm talking about is the terror that protected a particular kind of relationship. And the only thing that's changed is the form of the terror at any given moment, but the relationship continues to exist. And now you don't have a mob of white people who would necessarily come to your door. In most instances, you have a SWAT team who will come and do that. You have other forms of repression and coercion that the state assumes as it's necessary.
Uhuru, thank you for that. And I just want to remind everybody listening that we are talking to Chairman Omalia Shetela, and it's an honor to have you here, Chairman. I really unite with and know the history of what you're talking about of white women's complicity in carrying out the state terror as the white people's state, you know, playing a key role, frontline role of that in the terroristic attacks that are called lynchings, and like you're saying, egging on, pointing the finger at Africans for any contradiction a white woman may have to get the heat off of her, to you know, egging white men on to you know, murder and terrorize and lynch Africans, and to bring their children and pose them in front of
if
the...
If you really love me, you're killing.
And dress up their kids and bring them to take pictures of them in front of the lifeless bodies of Africans. And this is... this is the oppressed white woman struggling to... Yeah. Have equal role on the pedestal of on the backs of African people, and you know. And I also wanted to say that here in St. Petersburg, for people that don't know it, this is a city where the African community, the entire community, was on lockdown after I think it was 9 o'clock at night every night. They could not leave the area. Just a few mile area, right?
2 square miles.
2 square miles, right here near the Uhuru House. After 9 o'clock at night, they could not leave the community. And also that in downtown St. Petersburg on Central Avenue, there were green benches, and an African caught sitting on that. It was for the white tourists and the white people. If an African sat on that bench, he or she would be arrested. And this is not that long ago, not that long before you were growing up and here. So I also wanted to ask you about your experience in the U.S. Army. You know, and it was at a time when you know, so many colonial wars were being waged by the U.S., certainly against the people of Vietnam. There was Korea a little bit before
Congo.
That. Congo. And many other places, and that at that time the U.S. was really having a threat, a constant ongoing threat against the Soviet Union of that time, and you were in Berlin, Germany. So maybe you could talk about that situation and how you came to consciousness as, you know, at the time that you were in the U.S. Army.
Well, I joined the U.S. Army. I had barely turned 18 years old. And in fact, I had quit school, my senior year, I quit high school, in part because of the same kinds of contradictions that we're talking about. And I joined the U.S. Army because I had assumed that what I was confronted with in this St. Petersburg, et cetera, was due to the fact that I'm living in a small southern town and I could join the army, and, you know, there was all this freedom, you know, that was elsewhere for me. Of course, it's literally true that on the train that I got on to leave St. Petersburg, Florida to be inducted into the military, we, from that point on, ran into the whole white nationalist attacks on African people on the train, I was in Berlin, Germany. As you mentioned, I was in Berlin when the wall, the Berlin Wall, was built. That became the symbol of communist oppression. And it was really interesting when I got to Berlin. It was something like 14 years or so after the military defeat of German Nazism, this horror, German Nazism. But the reality is that the problems that I had in Germany was with white people from the United States, soldiers, U.S. soldiers. There were constant battles between Africans and white soldiers, you know, all over Berlin, and was treated better by the German, quote-unquote, Nazis, who they just got this thing with Jesse Owens that's out there today, tell you how you should understand that question. I was treated better by Germans than I was by African people and by white people in the United States. Like I said, I was there when the Berlin Wall was created. I was in one of the first U.S. tanks that faced a Soviet tank in a military confrontation. I was in the tanks. I was there. I remember sitting in a tank in freezing weather, because this is the first time I've ever lived in snow, cold weather. I came from St. Petersburg, and literally when I got to Germany, I literally thought that it was impossible for a human being to live. I saw evidence of human beings living because I saw white people living, etc. But I just thought I would die. I really thought I was going to die in the weather. And I wore all of the military winter gear that the U.S. military had. I had on everything, and I was still freezing, right? But I'm in a tank, freezing in a tank, and in the middle of the night at Checkpoint Charlie, which was the main checkpoint separating what they call Eastern Berlin from the Soviet-occupied Berlin from Western Berlin, occupied by the French, the U.S., and the British. And we listened to music on our radios, and the best music you can get came from the Soviet side. And I never forget how one night we were sitting there, and this woman says that now we're going to play a song by Louis Armstrong called Peace Down South. And then she said, but of course, there's been no peace down south since the civil rights movement started, right? And, you know, which reminds you right away this blazing struggle is happening with African people who are being having dogs sicked on us, or cattle prods, and the whole bit. And so I'm raging, and, you know, other Africans, you know, are having a serious experience with this. We have an experience in the army. You know, already we're fighting these white soldiers on a regular basis, and what's happening to our people in the United States. And I got a gun, which was also an interesting thing. I mean, there are stories that could be told about the guns and how, you know, on one night, we lived in this this compound where the tanks were. The tank outfit was separate from infantry and other military outfits. And somebody looked out the window, and one of the tank, you know, the turret of the tank with the big guns, a 90 millimeter gun with an 11 mile range on it, right? Fires this huge round, and this the turret of the tank was turning, and I looked out. It's the middle of the night. Who in the hell is in a tank? And the tank was turning, and now it's aimed at the officer's thing, right? And so so people rushed out, and they saw you in the damn tank. You know, it's in Africa. Who decided to take the entire thing out, but they, you know, saw you was pulled out of the tank. You know, and I'm in Berlin, Germany, and in Germany, the other thing that was helpful about it is you get an opportunity, or I got an opportunity, to look at the U.S. from over here, mm-hmm. you know, right. And not immediately tied up in the contradictions as they exist there. But I'm now watching this thing, and it helped to really escalate a certain kind of radicalization that I was experiencing. And that was a part of the same experience that Africans were having throughout the United States. And that was probably a period very much like the period that we are in now. You know, I left Germany and was sent to, of all places, to Fort Benning, Georgia. When I left Germany, I had decided that I was going to die when I got back to the United States. I knew I was going to die because I had decided that if any white person, I'm just reading all this stuff that's happening, you know, Africans being attacked. If any white person attacked me when I got back to the U.S., I was going to kill him. There was no question in my mind about that. It wasn't, you know, maybe I'll get angry or I was going to kill them. That was what I had determined. And of course, nothing like that happened, and I'm still alive. But what began to happen, I go to Fort Benning, Georgia, and I get in situations where Africans who are on the base in Fort Benning would go into town, and they'd come back all beaten up. The cops have done horrible things to them. I'd go to the snack bar that was on the base, and the white woman who ran the snack bar would refuse to take my money. She would hold her hand so that my hands couldn't touch her hand when I'm handing her the money. This is, are you crazy? You understand? And so I would force her to take the money, and then I got a complaint. I was sent for by the sergeant major who had this complaint because the woman said I was trying to hold her hand. And that led to some serious nastiness on my part. You know, I was really nasty and really unflattering in my description of why there's no way in hell I would have been holding the white woman's hand or trying to. And he didn't want to talk about it anymore. But then the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis happens. I'm in Fort Benning, Georgia. No, before that happens, you have a situation where I think it was, I'm trying to remember where the big thing happened in Georgia. Where was it? A huge civil rights struggle, and it got really violent and tense and serious. And so they said they were going to send U.S. military forces into Georgia. And they had us to be prepared to go into Georgia, the military force. And then they said, you can't believe this. They said, we're not going to give the black GIs any ammunition. You can have the gun, but you can't have an ammo. So, but that was cool. I didn't give a damn. If I went there and I had a gun, if there was ammunition, I was going to get ammunition. So I didn't worry about it. I said, yes, let's go in. And of course, they changed their minds about that. But what did happen was they sent this troop, this group on a convoy from Fort Benning, Georgia, to Patrick Air Force Base near Cocoa because of the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis. And we were there to be prepared to fight the Cubans when they hit the beachhead and this kind of thing. And on the way there, the convoy stopped in a place called Palatka, Florida. And the convoy stopped and everybody's going to get off and go eat in the restaurant. I'm the only African in the crowd. So we go into the restaurant and the white woman said, no, we can't serve you. Talking about me. So the officer who's, I'm going to fight the Cubans for this white woman, you understand, you know. So the officer says to me, oh, don't worry about it. We'll bring you something out. Oh, what an education. Wow. This is wonderful. Wow. This is so wunderbar. And so all of this stuff is happening and really informing me. And so by the time I've quit the army, literally, I quit. And I created havoc, you know, in the whole outfit. The whole battalion was in a state of serious crisis. I had begun to post political pieces on the bulletin boards all over the crisis, raising up the African black question and all of this stuff. And they sent me to psychiatrists because you got to be crazy. You don't like white people. And they did the whole thing. And finally, what they decided to do, because I wrote John F. Kennedy a 13-page letter telling him I wanted out of his army, that I'm not going to be in any institution protecting this stuff, and you know, et cetera. So they later sent for me and told me they were going to give me a discharge, that you're going to be out and such. And I said, wonderful, that suits me just fine. I stopped going to work. I wouldn't go to work. I stay in my bunk, you know, and they recognized I wasn't going to work. And there was this Jewish guy. His name was, I think his name was Stein, who he didn't want to be in the army either.
So he was going to do what I did and stay in his bunk and not get up in the morning. So it was really funny because the sergeant would walk right past me in the bunk and go to Stein's bunk and turn it over and flip him out. to flip him out of the bunk. So these were, you know, really...
It was your solidarity force.
Yeah, that was my solidarity force. So it was a real interesting period, and I forced them to let me out. So I came out. They didn't just let me out. They put me in a truck on the armed guard. they said, okay, we're going to let you out. And then they had a problem after saying they were going to discharge me because my record was too good for them just to kick me out of the Army, right? So they said 7 days before I'm supposed to get a discharge, they said, we're going to court-martial you. There are three things. We're going to court-martial you for these three things. And this was, I think, it might have been a general court-martial, but it's one that nobody wins. You don't win this court-martial. You go before a single officer, and then he makes the decision. It's a rigged thing.
Right.
And but I wasn't worried because what I did was I called as witnesses for my trial every African in the battalion. So no Africans went to work that day. They were all lined up to come testify at my trial.
Wow.
And what happened was by the time the last person testified, the whole African population on the post had been so contaminated politically that to have convicted me would have been a serious problem. They would have had a rebellion, an armed rebellion on their hands. So anyway, they ended up, reluctantly finding me not guilty. And then they put me on a truck.
That's amazing.
Yeah, put me on a truck. And then my dear friend who was the orderly, the person who worked in the company commander's office, his name was McCall. He said, he came to me, Walter, oh man, be careful because they're going to have a gun. They're going to put you on this truck on armed guard and, et cetera. I mean, McCall thought they planned to do something. He was in the company commander's office, so maybe he knew something. But, I said,
wow.
Drop me off. That's fine with me. And so they gave me a discharge. What was it? Honorable conditions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and I came back to the U.S., and I was extraordinarily angry because I felt like I had been bamboozled, tricked, and what have you, and was just awakening in a certain way. And so that contributed to, how I moved subsequent. I ended up first going to work as a laborer once I got outside of the Army, and then ended up for a period of time working for the St. Petersburg Times. I happened to be in Watts during the rebellion that happened there, and which was an extraordinary experience for me.
Chairman, didn't you leave the St. Pete Times to go to Watts?
I left the St. Pete Times for the march in Mississippi.
Selma March?
No, the Mississippi. The march against, I think, the one that initially was started by what's his name? Meredith. Was Meredith?
Oh, Meredith. The Meredith March.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And so that's when I asked them for a leave of absence. And the white boss told me that I don't think you should do this, and that if you really want to help your people, just stay here and work real hard and set an example for them. And I thanked him anyway. And so that's how I lost my job at the St. Petersburg Times. And they said that if you go, not only will you lose your job, you'll never ever be able to come back anymore. And so to this day, I can't get a job at the St. Petersburg Times.
Wow. Well, tell the story about what the psychiatrist in the Army said.
Well, it's interesting because the first psychiatrist, they brought a psychiatrist in. This guy was a lieutenant. They brought him in, and I was messing with the guy. They brought him in to see me. And in talking to me, I frightened him. I was just so black. And, I frightened him. And so you have to understand part of what was happening.
this was a horrible situation. You know, like the Africans knew who I was, eventually began to see who I was. And like white people, you know, just do horrible things. The GIs would come up and, you know, tell you dirty jokes about black people and stuff like that. And so I'm walking across the compound and African sergeant, I forgot his name, was he said, come to tell Waller that joke. Tell Waller that joke. That's what they called me, right? And the white guy would come and say, well, did you hear the joke about the nigger or the black guy and such a thing? And, you know, I said something really that he couldn't handle. But I was always polite when I said it. I never raised my voice or anything like that. And so then they didn't ask me those kinds of questions anymore. They knew not to. And, you know, I was walking out of the mess hall. I'm passing the sergeant who was a really big shot guy on the compound. I pass him. I say, Sarge, you raping any babies lately? And just keep walking, right? And so the guy, he's stunned. You know, he acts it so casually and just keep going. So the guy, but I haven't violated anything. I haven't broken any military laws or anything like that. And I was just creating all kinds of issues and consternation havoc for them. And what was the question that you just raised?
About the psychiatrist.
So the psychiatrist, I was messing with the psychiatrist and I scared him. And so they sent me to the main base to talk to the psychiatrist. And this guy was a major. And so, you know, we're talking and I'm giving him the same bit that I just gave the lieutenant who I scared to death. And the major said, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just a Garveyite.
I said, amazing.
Okay. I didn't even know what a Garveyite was. You understand? But I figured I probably was. And but what I tell you something interesting. In Berlin, there was this white guy. His name was David Manis. And Manis was a weird guy. He worked in the supply room. Anytime you had to get, you know, outfits and clothing and gear, you had to go to get it from the supply room, and Manis was the guy who was there. But he was weird. Manis was a guy, you walk into the mess hall, he'd be eating, and he's always reading something. So he'd feed his eye, he's feeding his ear, because he's reading while he's eating, and food is all in his forehead and stuff like this. So he was a really weird guy, and, but Manis was the guy who introduced me to Malcolm X.
Wow.
An article in the newspaper, you know, he showed me, what do you think of this? You know, introduced me to Malcolm X. And, he was reading stuff that was supposed to be pretty radical, like Lawrence Ferlinghetti and, other kind of radical, like white guys and stuff like that, you know. Really interesting guy Manis was. Mm-hmm. That's why I remember his name, in many ways. But Manis was a radical of a really hidden kind of deep radical. I mean, Manis was a guy who would figure out things, like he would create a problem for himself. Like, if he were in the Middle Ages, how would he go about creating a tank? You know, knowing what I know, how would I make it happen? That kind of stuff. You know, he was a weird and interesting.
Wow!
Kind of
yeah,
guy,
he sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I guess he would be called a nerd today.
Yeah, I guess he was a nerd. But I like Manis. I like Manis. He was cool. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, Chairman, when you got out of the Army, you came back to St. Pete, and you said, you know, you were working for the St. Pete Times,
right,
and doing other things. When did you join the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee? And say a little bit about what you did, because I think you went around the state. You weren't just here in the city, were you?
No. What happened was I ended up functioning as a kind of campaign manager for an African lawyer here who was running for some kind of office. He was pretty, you know, down kind of guy.
What was his name?
His name was Frank Peterman.
Oh.
And I was very close to his wife, who was, she came to the St. Petersburg Times as a writer while I was still working there.
Right, right.
And I came down from the composing room, which is where I was working at the time. And I said, I just came up and wanted to see what an Uncle Tom looked like. I said this to her, you know, and we became great friends after that. You know? So, So I became his campaign manager through, you know, knowing her and what have you. And we were all friends. At the end of the campaign, the Congress of Racial Equality had a conference in Frogmore, South Carolina. It's kind of notorious in many ways because there are pictures mm-hmm. of Martin Luther King there that they call it the communist meeting that he was attended going mm-hmm. back a long time mm-hmm. ago. And when I got to Frogmore, South Carolina, there a lot of Africans were there from various places around the country who were organizing, learning how to run for political office, right? One of the persons who was there was a man named John Dew, D-U-E.
Right.
Who was a lawyer. He worked for the Congress of Racial Equality. They paid him, in theory, I think $1,500 a year, or $15,000 maybe a year in theory. But he wore shiny suits and, but he was an incredible man. He really was. He's a genius, among other things. Mm-hmm. Just an incredible man who did everything he could to represent people, mm-hmm. Africans, mm-hmm. and risked his life. He was in Mississippi, and they almost killed him. In fact, they were trying to hunt him down and kill him, and they caught instead some poor Indian student who they thought was him and did horrible things to him. And John, leaving Frogmore, John asked me to work as an organizer for six counties in Florida, the Voter Education Anti-Poverty Project, VEAP. And the guy who was over the entire project, national project, was a man named Vernon Jordan, who was responsible for Barack Hussein Obama mm-hmm. being the president, and whose aunt or some other relative is in Barack Obama's office right now, and who became one of the persons on more corporations in this country than anybody else, not only Africans, but he was on the board of corporations, a wealthy, filthy, rich, African. And John asked me to take on the responsibility, and I became an organizer there. It's also where I ran into many people from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and I was already impressed by SNCC, mm-hmm. about what I knew and heard of SNCC, and the Black Power thing had just popped. I did that work for John for the Voter Education Anti-Poverty Program in Northern Florida for a while. And then I came back to St. Petersburg to organize the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And I worked with an incredible young man whose name was John Bryant, whom I had grown up with, gone to high school with, junior high school as they called it at the time as well. And and I were the primary forces who organized SNCC here. And, before organizing SNCC, I had done things like organizing boycotts of local establishments here, closing down some establishment that treated African people badly, that kind of thing. So I had become extremely active, and SNCC was the thing that caught our attention, and John and I were the primary forces who brought SNCC, who hooked up with SNCC, and organized the first membership organization of SNCC that ever existed, and the first SNCC organization that was based in the African working class as opposed to a student organization. It was not an organization of volunteers who would go in and, Saul Alinsky, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. teach the, untutored masses, how to do stuff. But we were actually people from the class ourselves, and that's who we brought into organizational life.
That's powerful.
Yeah. And the thing the thing that's really interesting about that, too, is that the SNCC found itself as an organization with a dilemma. Because you saw the rise, ultimately, of the Black Panther Party, and SNCC had all of his work had been, you know, like in the South and in the country, and urban resistance had begun to spring up. Mm-hmm. And so SNCC was trying to solve the problem of becoming involved, like, in urban struggle. That's how this courtship happened with the Black Panther Party and stuff like that. What's really interesting is that the SNCC organization that I headed here in St. Petersburg was urban-based, Black working class-based. Mm-hmm. And the symbol for the SNCC organization here, the big wall, the big picture on the wall was the Black Panther, because SNCC created the Black Panther in Lowndes County, Alabama. So the Black Panther was being born right here in St. Petersburg, Florida, as it was being born in Oakland, California. And what's more interesting, perhaps, is we've talked about the mural 50 years ago. This year, I snatched a variously defined as 7x10 or 8x4 foot mural from the wall of the city hall here in St. Petersburg, and you know, was arrested and charged with a lot of charges and went to prison for it. That was on December 29th, 1966.
Yeah.
What's really interesting is that in many ways this was the first round that had been fired in what was developing in terms of direct action and resistance in the African liberation movement in this country. That happened and gathered international news of, you know, us marching down the street with that mural in our hands. December 29, 1966. On May 2nd, 1967, a group of men walked into the Sacramento legislature with guns for a demonstration, and that's the thing that blew the Black Panther Party up in the country and around the world. And I was in jail, in a prison cell, when they did that in 1967. So what we're looking at is a real kind of trend, and I think the precedent was established in St. Petersburg, Florida, the seat of government. That's where that mural hung, at the seat of government, and then the seat of government where they wanted to challenge the gun laws in California.
The opening salvo of the Black Power era, you know?
Yeah.
That's really, really important to hear that context. You know, it wasn't just something that happened here locally,
that's
but it resonated all over and influenced the movement.
They had to have known it. They had to have been influenced by it, just as we were all influenced. Mm-hmm. We were all learning from each other, you know, when things like that were happening around the world. They had to have done that,
And it got national coverage.
It got national coverage.
Wow.
Jet Magazine. There's a big picture in Jet Magazine of us marching down the streets in Central Avenue with that damn mural. It was one of the most exciting things that happened during the period, the most exciting act of direct action. And this was really important, because when you got to the question of direct action as opposed to pleading and asking, et cetera, it was just a whole new era. And the fact the cop who arrested me on Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, Florida, on the streets there, who stopped me, didn't arrest me at the moment, because he was trembling. He was trembling. He was literally trembling. I mean, his whole body was shaking while he was holding onto my arm. And because it was a whole new thing that they were never had been confronted. The whole Black Power or mystique, the whole thing of a new generation of African people who were so daring, they'd walk into the city hall, tear it down, who were in your face, you know, with their blackness. This was something they had never encountered before. And like I said, the cop was literally trembling. He was literally trembling when he grabbed me, and which is why he couldn't hold me.
Wow, the Black Power. That's
exactly
what it is.
Exactly.
And white power has so much fear of it.
Yeah.
It's really, really powerful.
Yeah.
Well, Chairman, we're almost at the end of our time here, and how incredible. And we just got to the very beginning. We haven't even gotten to Jomo yet, but I'm so glad we got to talk a little bit about the mural. And the next time, I think we should start there, because I know there's more to say about that and the trials around it and et cetera. So thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
This has been incredible to hear and to discuss with you, and such an honor. So thank you, Chairman.
We do have a couple more minutes, if there's any last remarks you wanted to make, Chairman.
Well, just that it was an important era. And, you know, right now in the city of St. Petersburg, people want to talk about that mural. And the city is trying to take ownership of the act of resistance that took the mural down, and they're talking about replacing it with something that they're going to have some judges declare as best representative.
I mean, I just want to make the comment, replacing it 50 years later, was empty all that time. They could never replace it politically. I mean, that is so amazing.
And they still have a problem because they said they were going to replace it. And I said, how are you going to replace it? You haven't said anything to the art critic that's responsible for it not being there. And that was a problem for them. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, they're putting it on hold. That's I read it in the newspaper. Anyway, they said
they're putting it on hold again?
That's what the newspaper said. They're putting it on hold again. So maybe 50 years later.
Maybe 100 years.
If the place still exists. 50 years later, it'll be ours. But,
yes. It'll be, imperialism will be gone.
Red, down black, the drain. And green. And,
exactly.
Uhuru. Uhuru, I just also want to thank you, Chairman. That was really incredible. And I think we're still 50 years from today at the point that we ended with the work of SNCC leading up to. So we have a lot more history to cover, and it's an incredible history because it's not just looking at the past. These are the events that lead to this moment in time right now where, as you've said, you know, the reemergence of Black power after two generations of military defeat. And it's an honor to have you on the show today, and we look forward to continuing this series of interviews with you on the history of the chairman and the history of the Uhuru movement. And I just want to say that the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, this year, which is such a historic year, the 40th anniversary of the African People's Solidarity Committee that was formed right here in St. Petersburg, in the very same city, we are holding the National Convention of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, which is APSC's mass organization, and it's called the Reparations Challenge, White Solidarity with Black Power, and we have many new people that are coming to the convention, but we also want to put a call out to anyone who has ever stood in solidarity to come back. If you're out there, we have people that have been coming back to the movement in this era when the African People's Socialist Party is on the ascendancy in such a massive way. And we want to see this almost as like the great reunion of the solidarity movement. Great. So I want to even make a shout out, David Manis and Stein, wherever you guys are, come out to St. Petersburg. We'd love to meet you for the National Convention. And that's April 16th and 17th. 2016, right here in St. Petersburg, Florida, Aquaba Hall, 1245 18th Avenue South. And you can register online. It's $40 for both days. Register at usmconvention.eventbrite.com. Our keynote speaker will be Chairman Omali Yeshitela. Chairwoman Penny Hess will also be speaking, as well as the International President of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, Herdoja Bentham, who's traveling from St. Louis, Missouri, and Gazi Kodzo, the National Director of the National Office of Recruitment and Membership of the African People's Socialist Party. It is sure to be an extremely memorable and historic milestone for the work of APSC and the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. So thank you. You've been listening to Reparations in Action. I also want to appreciate our wonderful engineer, Eric, and all of our listeners out there for tuning in. And be sure to tune in next week, 1 o'clock Eastern Time, on uhururadio.com for the weekly episode of Reparations in Action. Uhuru.
Uhuru.